So I would like, first of all, to thank the organizers for inviting me and doing such a marvelous job on this conference. I would like to discuss here an interrelation which has recently come from photoemission experiments on superconducting and antiferromagnetic gaps in high TC compounds. And we believe this sets up a test case for any microscopic theory of the high TC compounds, in particular also for the theory I'm interested in, which is the so-called SO5 theory. What is the experiment about? The experiment is a photoemission experiment by the Shan Stanford group, which looks at the photoemission data along the magnetic Brillouin zone. And what they detected, and I will describe it in somewhat more detail, is on top of an S-wave, if you like, large background antiferromagnetic gap, a modulation which has a D-wave-like lobe structure. And this modulation immediately suggests that there is an interrelation to the D-wave superconducting gap, and this sets up this test case I will discuss in more detail. What I in particular would like to tell you is that we believe that the SO5 theory, when it is however modified compared to the original Zhang version, and this means we do take into account the Mott-Hubbard gap and project higher energy states out, you will see that this is very essential, then this projected SO5 description is in fact very naturally giving such a relation, and this can be considered as a test case for this theory, which aims at relating antiferromagnetic and superconducting states and tries to unify these states. Okay, so let me very briefly give you just one glance at the SO5 description, which in its original version was mathematically invented by Su Sheng Zhang. I will discuss this very briefly. And then we have, in my group over the last years, been really interested in seeing whether this SO5 concept makes some sense looking at the microscopic models around for high TC compounds and the physics of the high TC compounds. So as you probably know, this SO5 scheme tries to unify antiferromagnetism and superconductivity via some rotation between these very different, physically very different states, this being an ideal insulator and this being, of course, an ideal metal or superconductor. And there are, of course, other examples in physics. One can think of such a unifying process. Now, why we are interested in general in this question is very obvious, because all of the high TC compounds, when you look at the phase diagram in temperature versus doping, have in their close vicinity antiferromagnetic and superconducting phases. So clearly, an important question is to understand what is the precise relationship between these two phases. Are they independent, or do they influence the high transition temperatures? And I would like to discuss the question, are these two phases related by some kind of a symmetry transformation? Now let me come back and make somewhat more precise this experiment I was outlining in my first transparency, this ARPIS experiment, which was on this insulating compound by the Stanford group. So these people did photoemission looking for the K-dependent valence band photoemission along this magnetic Brillouin zone, and then when they plotted the energy as a function of momentum K with respect to a reference point at on this magnetic Brillouin zone, they observed a dispersion of the photoemission data which scales linearly with this magnitude of D form factor, cosine ky minus cosine kx magnitude. Okay, so this is only photoemission, but since all the microscopic descriptions like Hubbard TGA models assume electron hole symmetry, this would translate also into a corresponding modulation of the gap features. So we can assume a D-wave-like modulation of the gap on top, of course, of a large Mott Hubbard background, which is of the order of 2 electron volts, or U typically. And
is this the gap in produced by the antiferromagnetic.
Yeah, this is the usual gap for electron hole excitations. Okay, so the question is, how can this be a test case for the microscopic theory, and how in general can we describe this? And in order to understand this, let me give you a physical picture which we have worked on in our group, how the SO5 theory makes sense from a physics point of view in general, or how it could make sense. And this physical picture starts out with this type of spin liquid, if you like, or the state close or at half filling above the nil temperature. And there we know we have already pairing phenomena. The spins on copper sides tend to form singlets. Now what I will show you is that these singlets can be locally excited to triplets, and we have magnons. And these magnons condense, and via a condensation process give rise to an antiferromagnetic order here. Well, how can this happen? Well, Robert Eder and my group showed in my opinion, actually an important paper, that these triplet excitations can disperse through the spin liquid, exchanging with a singlet, and typically you would have an energy dispersion of order J, magnetic energy scale. But he could show that at characteristic wave factors, the Bragg wave factor pi pi, the magnon dispersion goes to zero, and then we can macroscopically fill the state by magnons, which are essentially bosons, and we can have a condensation process into a long-range antiferromagnetic state. I'll come back to this. Now, when we dope the system, then we replace the building blocks for the antiferromagnet, the magnon, by hole pairs, and I will argue that we have a very similar, formally similar, condensation process, which describes then the superconducting state, where we have condensed hole pairs on top of the spin liquid or Fermi liquid. Okay, and the pi SO5 rotation, which we call pi, rotates us from one building block to the other and back. Okay, how, first of all, could we visualize this antiferromagnetic state? Well, as I already said, basically what happens is you have a dispersion, which I will come back actually later towards the end of my talk. I'll show you this in more detail. And this is of order J, but goes characteristically to zero at this minimum wave factor, which is pi pi. And then we can, sorry for the misspelling, macroscopically occupy this state here, and this is a coherent state. So this state, you know from many other fields of physics, means that we project onto the spin liquid one, if we multiply it out, two, a macroscopic number of triplets. And they can condense and thereby form a static moment or an antiferromagnetic order. And you can visualize this relatively easily, at least in a hand-waving argument for which I have time here, but not more. Namely, again, sorry for the misspelling. You consider a fixed nearest neighbor configuration, I and J, in the lattice. And then, as I said, I have a singlet in my spin liquid. Now, if I project onto this or add to this a triplet in the C configuration, I'm erasing the second fluctuating possibility and left with a fixed nearest neighbor configuration. Now, since these bosons condense at pi pi, you get phase coherence all over the plane, and it's easy to show that such a state gives you antiferromagnetic order. In particular, the density of triplets gives you, or is corresponding to, the magnitude of the magnetic moment. So this explains, in principle, the antiferromagnetic state. So how do we get the superconducting state? Well, you know that from BCS theory, I have a variational wave function which is very reasonable for the superconducting state, where in principle I do something very similar to this antiferromagnetic description, namely I am creating via this product over all possible k's a macroscopic number of hole pairs. And you have these phase factors UK and VK. And the hole pairs are created in the spin liquid via doping or changing the chemical potential. And now the anti-ferromagnet is formally very similarly described by again having similar phase factors UK tilde and VK tilde, and the only thing is I'm exchanging the Cooper pair operator by the Magnon operator here. And then I'm creating in my spin liquid, which I called here Fermi liquid, a macroscopic number of triplets, and they give the anti-ferromagnetic state. So let's look at this construction in some more detail. So one building block for the anti-ferromagnet is the Magnon operator, which is a particle hole excitation with respect to half filling. The other building block in the superconductor is the Cooper pair, where this Pauli matrix describes the right S equals zero state I'm considering here. So at first you would say, okay, these are seemingly very different states of matter, but we have already seen that they could be formally equivalent if I could replace the Magnon operator by the Cooper pair operator. And this is exactly provided by Zhang's construction. He constructed first this pi operator, and this construction is very simple because basically you just have to remember simple quantum mechanics. If I want to rotate from here to here, I have to have a commutation relation which involves an operator, and this is this operator, which patches up the difference in quantum numbers. So this, for example, carries no charge. This carries two holes, for example, charge 2, and therefore this has to carry charge plus or minus 2, depending on whether I look at pi or pi dagger. This has, for example, S equal 1. We just discussed that this is a triplet operator. This is S equal 0, so this operator, because of the Pauli matrices, is a triplet operator. And so on, this carries momentum Q, this doesn't, so we have a Q here. And this fixes this construction apart from a phase factor. And the phase factor, this has actually been shown first by Chris Handley and also by co-workers of Susheng Zhang, is uniquely determined by the group closure requirement. And this has this sign of the D wave form here. Okay, so let me now go back and just work out whether I did the right calculation, so to speak. And so now I'm looking at whether indeed the pi operator rotates me from the Magnon onto the Cooper pair. And so you can look at the commutation relation, and as I said before, a rotation in quantum mechanics means, of course, that I have to evaluate a commutator. And indeed, the pi rotates me from the Magnon onto the Cooper pair, but I'm catching, in addition, this D-wave form factor. And similarly, the adjoint operator rotates me from the Cooper pair onto the Magnon, and I'm having, in addition, this D-wave form factor. And this already, if you like, is the, in a way, elegant answer to at least this, at least parts of this photoemission experiment. Namely, if I start with a D-wave form of the Cooper pair wave function, let's say here, then because I'm catching an additional form factor, the Magnon wave function will have always this magnitude of D wave form because of this additional factor here. Okay? And this means, and I'll come back to this in more detail, that a D superconducting symmetry of the gap has to be plotted onto a magnitude of D gap modulation. Okay, so let's now make this, however, more detailed, but before I go into this, let me summarize the central idea of the physical content of SO5. So basically the central idea is we start from some kind of spin liquid, which in this work which I discussed was taken to be short-range RVB, but I will actually come to a totally different description which also works, which is more Fermi liquid-like in the end. So we can have these triplet excitations here in this spin liquid, and they can condense and form an anti-ferromagnetic state described by three components. Similarly, if we dope, we have these hole pairs, and they can condense and give rise to two components of the superconducting order parameter, and this sets up a five-dimensional object, the SO5 superspin. And of course there are other examples in physics which I only mention because I would like to test this idea using these similar ideas. Like in nuclear physics, you know, you have the isospin algebra which unifies proton and neutron, and experimentalists would normally check this by spectroscopy. So what would this mean? This would mean that you successively replace in a series of nuclei protons by neutrons, and then the spectroscopic data, the state, should be related directly to the multiplet structure of the isospin algebra. And we'll do a very similar check and see whether known models work, and you will see we have to modify something very crucial here in these models here. Okay, so basic idea is now I take these effective models which have been discussed and very successfully so for many salient features of the high TC compounds, and I will confront these models with this SO5 idea. So we know that, for example, the Hubbard model, which has this energy scale U, describes correctly the high energy physics, if you like, of the Mott Hubbard insulating gap of order of electron volt. This model, as well as its strong coupling version, which is TJ model basically, also describes correctly the medium energy scale physics of order J, which is of the order of 0.1 electron volt, and this gives correctly or describes the salient magnetic features, as you know. But these models have never been convincingly, neither by analytical means nor by numerical techniques, been shown to yield superconductivity, and or have been shown what is the precise real ground state. We do not know at an energy scale of the superconducting gap, which is J divided by 10, we cannot resolve the possible competition here in these models between anti-ferromagnetic, superconducting, and so on, possible ground states. And sort of the basic idea is that, at least in principle, and I will show you how or how not, the SO5 symmetry description as a symmetry concept should be able to resolve this competition, in the sense that if I have a model such as this, which has long range anti-ferromagnetic order at half filling, and if this model has exactly SO5 symmetry, then by mathematics I know it has to have a Dirac superconducting ground state, and then I could describe microscopically the complex phase diagram of the high TC compounds, and let's just see to what extent this idea is correct. Okay, so how can we test for these models the SO5 idea? The basic idea is that we want to rotate from the anti-ferromagnetic onto the superconducting order parameter, or vice versa. And I have already mentioned one way to check this is to look into the multiplet structure, and let me illustrate this by comparing with an experimental example which you know. Let's say I take a nucleus which has an S equal 1 spin, total spin. Then, in general, I would have this multiplet structure which would be degenerate in the SCs here. Now, you know, if I apply homogeneous B field, these multiplets would split, and I could test the splitting or equal level spacing by NMR. And the simplest example of that, you know, of course, all is just if I have a spin precessing in a B field and it goes from +1 to -1 direction, and the precession frequency is proportional to this external parameter. Formally, something very similar happens with SO5. We have also a multiplet structure where certain levels correspond to the anti-ferromagnet, others to the superconductor, and we'll find a critical chemical potential where essentially all these multiplets are degenerate, and then we can freely rotate the anti-ferromagnet into the superconductor. But if we go away by doping or changing the chemical potential, then we'll have also equal levels, and I will show you this in a minute. Okay, so how can we test this? Well, we can test this rotation from the anti-ferromagnetic order parameter via the pi operator onto the superconducting state numerically in the following manner. And this brings me now to the second part of the homework where my main interest really was in the last 1 or 2 years. And this is the following. I have to ask the question whether the dynamics of the electrons is in accordance with this construction. So far this was a nice mathematical construction, but now I have to really ask whether the Hamiltonian commutes with the generator of the symmetry, and ideally I should have a zero on the right hand side. Okay, then I can have simultaneous eigenstates and this would be very nice. Now in general, I will show you this, what we find is that there is a precession frequency, exactly like in our spin example, times the operator on the right hand side. So we have a so-called eigenoperator equation, which you know from the harmonic oscillator, but you know it also from an example which is much more in the content of what I'm discussing, namely if I apply a magnetic field to a spin system, then I'm generating S plus and S minus rising and lowering operators which exactly fulfill such a relation. And the distance between the ladder rungs is just this precession frequency. This is the energy in our case required to rotate the anti-ferromagnetic onto the superconducting state. And if I have such a ladder, I could easily test whether this is okay, because I should see in an optical experiment one and the same interband, inter-rung distance in energy. So let's just look at it. And this is a typical example. In the meantime, we have of course done much more, but this was early exact diagonalization on a typical Hubbert model, and it shows a typical result. So we calculate the pi spectral function or correlation function, and we find a sharp peak at low energies. This is this omega. So this is very nice, which scales with J and the whole count away from half filling. So this energy essentially would go to zero at the top of the valence band. Okay, but you see that there is also an incoherent background, and this incoherent background is due to a symmetry breaking effect, which is the Mott Hubbert gap, because if I rotate I'm also creating electronic excitations across the gap, and somehow I would like to get rid of this high energy scale in the low energy physics I'm really after, and I'll come back to this. But for the time being, let's just remember there are two symmetry breaking effects. One is actually the doping, or this 1 minus n, because this creates this precession frequency which breaks the SO5 symmetry in a natural manner, and the Mott Hubbert gap. Okay, so on the basis of these results, we then construct an effective Hamiltonian which describes what we just discussed. So we have in our Hamiltonian an SO5 symmetric part plus two symmetry breaking effects. One is the chemical potential scaling with doping, and one is the Mott Hubbert gap, which is, in our case, we just take it to be the Hubbert U, the Hubbert interaction, which projects out the high energy occupancies if we make U very large. The SO5 interaction, we take to be as simple as possible. We take just the nearest neighbor hopping, because this is already SO5 invariant. And the interaction part we take, as we discussed before in terms of our physical picture, to have a symmetry between the superconducting part and the magnetic triplet, magnon part. The superconducting part, I just take the simplest I can do, which is dictated by experiment, namely a nearest neighbor D waveform for the pairing here, operator. And this is then fixed by SO5 symmetry, the magnetic part. So let me just show you if this picture has something correct in it. It should work already on a very simple level. And the simplest level you can do, like in superconductivity, is just BCS weak coupling mean field. And the corresponding to the BCS weak coupling mean field is the SDW description for the anti-ferromagnet. Okay, so you know, in both cases, here and in the BCS, you get the order parameter, for example, the magnetic moment related to the gap and to this energy which contains the gap. And here, similarly, this is the superconducting order parameter, and similarly, it's related to the gap. And we have one universal gap equation, which is the same, and it contains a non-local interaction part. Now, in the interaction part, the difference comes into play. Namely, we have two differences. One I described already in terms of general symmetry arguments. The symmetry factors here for the superconducting part have to be really d-width. In the antiferromagnetic part, in the magnum part, they have to be magnitude of d. This is a general reason for the comes from the SF5 assumption. The difference is also that in the antiferromagnetic part, the large energy scale U enters, whereas here it drops out. The simple reason is precisely the D-wave form of the symmetry guarantees that if you have a constant U here and you have the plus minus in the gap features, the U drops out, or simply speaking, the on-site Coulomb correlation is not entering the superconducting correlation or consideration. So this enters only in the antiferromagnet. Because of this, it's very trivial to evaluate self-consistently this gap. And the antiferromagnetic gap indeed has a large background, if you like, S-wave component, which is of order U, plus a modulation, which is easy to find to be of order J, times this magnitude of D form factor, which we have discussed before. And of course, the superconducting gap is of order, we have adjusted, this was the only parameter here, so the magnitude here has to be adjusted, and this is automatically then coming out. And of course, the symmetry is here clearly D. Okay, so this then, to summarize, I can show you. No, this depends on you. If you do this more carefully, this is a typical calculation we did. This depends on you. So, for example, the gap modulation for large U saturates, this is very important. And, for example, for U equals 6, it would have this value. And for U equals 6, the superconducting gap would have this value. But this slightly depends. We have done variational Monte Carlo evaluations of that, and it's slightly differs from this simple BCS picture. Okay, so the interrelation then, to summarize this, is that we have a constant gap of order U or electron volt, and on top of this we have this D-wave-like gap modulation in the antiferromagnet, and it has this energy scale J, and the superconducting gap has this different energy scale. And this by itself, the difference in energy scales is very interesting, because this was a puzzle, and for example Patrick Lee has always asked this provocative question, why is the TC so low? Well, it is so low because of these effects, in our opinion, partly the different entering of U in the antiferromagnet and in the superconductor. But let me last not least come to other descriptions. For example, descriptions involving more parameters in the standard Hubbard models like T prime and T double prime. And we have observed some interesting features here which I would like to discuss. Namely, I told you that the superconducting part we just take basically from experiment to be D wave and nearest neighbor. Because of SO5 symmetry, this fixes also the magnetic part, which I have in my SO5 Hamiltonian. So let's look at this magnetic part. And if we look at this Neil order parameter, it has an interesting internal structure in the SO5 description, which I've plotted here. So it's not just an on-site electron hole term, but it is an electron hole excitation which has some long-range nature. So you can argue in two ways to see that this may make really interesting sense. One is that you go to a mean field evaluation of this term, and then it's easy to show, because this describes electron hole hoppings or excitations, that you get a negative T prime effective, which is negative, and you get a third nearest neighbor positive T double prime, which by the way reflects the parameters found in numerical experiments within a few percent, and also gives you the right sign. And we believe this is no coincidence, but I would like to emphasize, here you really need the long-range nature to give you this straight D-wave-like form. The second thing I have no time to go into is that this structure also can be confronted with experiments on the magnetic dispersion at higher Q wave factors, and we are working on this particular around pi zero, where you have heard there are some deviations of the nearest neighbor spin wave model compared to the experiments. Now, last but not least, let me make a more general comment. What has been established here? The exact SO5 theory, as initially described by Zhusheng Zhang, and we have also worked on it, is still inconsistent, and we have to add the Mott Hubbard gap physics. And this I would briefly like to indicate because we believe this is very crucial. So the multiplet structure in the exact SO5 not only spans in SC, as like in my nucleus example, but also in doping, because I want to go from the antiferromagnet to the superconductor.
What is the inconsistency?
Okay, the inconsistency, for example, means that SO5 rotates charge into spin exactly, so we would get a spin gap. But this is inconsistent with antiferromagnetism because we have spin waves, we have no spin gap. So this symmetry has to be broken, and it is broken because of the presence of the Mott Hubbard gap. And I would like to illustrate this in the next few graphs. Okay, first I'm finished in 2 minutes. The idea is the following. This is the Mott Hubbard gap, and the SO5 description, as I emphasized, rotation does two things. It creates a pair of holes, but it also, parallel to this, puts two electrons on already occupied sites. Now, what I can do is I can artificially, of course, vary the chemical potential and put it here. So here I have no gap for hole excitation, so I'm in business, I should have no spin gap. But you see, I have a large gap for electronic excitations left. And this I have to project out for two electron excitations. And we have found that one can very elegantly project out this part by just changing the commutation relations of the superconducting order parameter operator, which is usually zero, but if you just replace it by this complex number, you have exactly Gutzwiller projected out this part. This you can then map, or we did map on a nonlinear sigma model, and I would like to just show you the first results for the corresponding phase diagram, but I have to warn you, these results treat this axis, the temperature axis, still as a classical fluctuation effect. So we calculate the T equals zero energy and treat classical temperature fluctuations. But nevertheless, the difference is obvious. In the exact SO5 description, we have an antiferromagnetic state just at mu equals zero and at rho equals zero. In the projected description, which takes the Mott Hubbard gap really into account, we enter here the superconducting regime at a finite mu c, which, if you like, is the top of the valence band. And in particular, plotted as a function of rho, we have an overlapping regime of antiferromagnetic and superconducting order. So the question is, how can this happen? This can happen because we have a prediction, basically, namely the chemical potential when you change the doping shouldn't change in a significant regime in the underdoped case. And this, by the way, is seen in ARPES data to a certain extent by the Shen group, that the chemical potential doesn't change until basically you reach the maximally doped regime. And in this regime, in the case where we are below rho c, we have both antiferromagnetism and superconductivity, and presently we are looking into the possibility of having other inhomogeneous phases like stripe phases. So let me summarize my talk just with this picture. What we presently believe is that the Hubbard model has to be supplemented by an interaction which shows up at low energy, which is the SO5 interaction. And let me just show you this picture so that it's clear what I mean. The idea here was that we worked with this type of Hamiltonian, which has the normal Hubbard hopping nearest neighbor. It has the Hubbard U, but it contains, in addition to the chemical potential, this SO5 part. And we believe that this SO5 part should show up at very low energies. We know that this Hamiltonian has antiferromagnetic long-range order, and then I have argued and shown you that this projected SO5 symmetry projects me on a D-wave superconductor, and these two states have the right gap feature. So there is some hope that this is going, hopefully, in a meaningful direction. Thank you.
Why doesn't it apply, for example, to three-dimensional
anti-ferro magnets? Yeah, okay. This is a very good question, and my answer is basically here. So people have asked me many times, why can't I do this, for example, for other states of matter? Yes, you can do this. If you give me the quantum numbers of your magnetic system, may it be ferromagnetic, and for example, the superconductor, let's say, has a finite momentum component due to a magnetic field, I can always calculate the difference in quantum numbers and construct the pi operator. This is relatively straightforward. Now, the main check comes exactly at this point. So then I have to see whether the dynamics of the electrons is in agreement with this construction. I have to commute this Hamiltonian with this thing. And this, for example, is a non-trivial calculation if you do it in a standard perturbative sense, as Stemmler, Zhang, and others have shown. But this is the crucial point. Then you would have to show that this is zero at a given point, in the doping space, for example, and that it relates away from this in this possession eigen operator fashion. Okay. I can answer also this question very simply. This is an extension of also my answer. You could argue, okay, why don't I take the pi operator to have a different symmetry, like S symmetry? Well, we did the calculation. So you see, this is not the peak here. I do not get a peak here at low frequencies. I just get an incoherent background. So the symmetry is not contained, the S symmetry in this rotation for this effective Hamiltonian of Hubbard type. Now, if I take a different Hamiltonian more appropriate to these materials, then the question is open whether I do not get, for example, an S or P wave symmetry rotation.
The short answer is yes. There was a lot of
yes.
And somebody else applying similar right. to P wave and paramagnetic questions as well.
Yeah, those SO5, when people measure it, is speed fluctuations or not?
No, that has, I wouldn't say that. That has very little to do. I think we still require the insight of this beautiful work of people like Doug Scalupino to give us, so to speak, details on the pairing. And this reflects then on finding, for example, that this rotation has D-wave symmetry. So this is entering the effective Hamiltonian construction and checks of this effective Hamiltonian towards magnetic excitations. There I would say this is an important picture. At higher energy scales, we have to we see beautifully the spin fluctuations and magnetic phenomena already in a normal state.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.